Every candidate has 2 minutes, and we will rotate who goes first. The first question will first be answered by Mr. Cardin, and then by Mr. Frosch, and then by Mr. Pritzker. And the question is, the Boast bill is of great importance to the Jewish community. Where do you stand on the issue? And as the Attorney General, how can you assist in its passage?
Thank you for the question. And this has been an issue. For those of you who aren't familiar, the Boast bill is a bill that would permit tax credits for institutions who make contributions to either public or private parochial educational facilities, and actually others. I believe the bill has included in the past museums and other cultural institutions, but not necessarily all public. They could be private. They could be, as long as they meet certain financial qualifications, it could be a private parochial school. I have been on record and will continue to be on record as supporting this kind of policy. The Supreme Court has upheld this as constitutional, and we ought to be finding as many ways as we can to provide partnerships between our public and private institutions and using our tax dollars in ways that actually promote the education and the growth of these institutions, which are important to all of us in making sure that each one of us has, and our families and our communities have, the best opportunity to be educated and to be provided services. What the Attorney General can do is make sure that, if a policy is passed by the legislature, make sure it's properly enforced, and it can also use its bully pulpit to help promote the important policies such as Boast or whatever you want to call it. I will say this, because I only have a few seconds left, that there's an idea of using state dollars for transportation to defer transportation costs, whether it be public or private. And that's a great way to create partnerships between public and private entities. Thank you.
Mr. Frosch.
Thank you. I do not support the Boast bill. And I oppose it for a couple of reasons. Let me say first, I respect people who want to send their kids to a parochial school, who want their kids to get a religious education. It's important. But I don't believe that the state should be in that business. And there are two reasons. First, practical. We don't have enough money to fund our public schools. Our public schools are ranked very high in the country, but we have a big achievement gap, and some of our schools are just plain inadequate. There are kids in this state going to schools where you can't drink from the water fountains, where you can't use the restrooms. And if we had all the money we needed for public schools, I would say it might be something we could consider. I would say it's still not a good idea as a matter of principle. Look, we are an historically oppressed religious minority. My grandparents, I'm sure your parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, came here for religious freedom. They came here so that they could be Jews and be open about it, and that there was no state-established religion. I think when we take the step of, when we move toward the government getting into the business of religious education, we endanger that freedom. It may be constitutional, but I think it's a bad move from a group that has suffered, bled and died all over the world for our religious beliefs. I think it's a big mistake. Thank you.
Mr. Pritzker.
Yes, I am the only non-politician up here, and I will tell you I have not studied this issue, but I will tell you that a tax credit for an institution which does provide education to students probably is not a bad idea. It's probably a good idea. The Attorney General's office at best would only have the option of rendering an opinion as to whether or not it's constitutional or non-constitutional, and thus far it has been found to be constitutional. There's always been the issue of parochial schools and whether there should be any direct funding, which I'm not in favor of at all. But in terms of a tax credit, which would benefit children, when you have a private, a public school system, which seems to be failing and which would allow private schools, particularly hopefully Jewish education, to have some benefit and perhaps more children could be enrolled, I think I would probably be in support of that. But that's really not an issue that the Attorney General would decide other than deciding its constitutionality.
Okay. The next question This will be answered in order from Mr. Frosch to Mr. Pritzker to Mr. Cardin. Do you support the death penalty? If not, are you prepared to tell the relatives of victims of a life-term criminal that there can be no further punishment?
I do not support the death penalty. I was one of the leaders in the effort to repeal the death penalty. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but I'll give you what I think is the most compelling that I saw in the many years that this issue was before my committee. There's a gentleman from Maryland. His name is Kurt Bloodsworth. He was convicted of a brutal rape and murder of a young girl. He was sentenced to death. He served on Maryland's death row for 2 years. He got another trial. At the second trial, he was convicted again. This time, however, he was sentenced to life without parole. 7 years later, when the science of DNA had been developed, Mr. Bloodsworth petitioned to have the evidence reviewed and analyzed for DNA. And it turned out, as he had said all along, he was innocent. He did not commit the crime. In fact, the person who did commit the crime happened to be in the same cell block as Mr. Bloodsworth, but he was innocent. And I don't think that it is just or moral for a state to run the risk of putting to death an innocent person. And we've seen this all over the country. People who have been convicted of many different crimes, some that carry the capital offense, some not. People are exonerated years after their convictions. I don't think it's appropriate for the state to run that risk, and I'm opposed to the death penalty.
Mr. Pritzker.
I am not opposed to the death penalty under certain circumstances. Mr. Frosch was wise enough to mention the DNA science that we have today, and the state, I believe, enacted a law a few years ago that provided for the death penalty under certain very limited circumstances, provided that you had DNA evidence and other evidence which was as close to incontrovertible as you can get. I think that people have to start realizing that there are some crimes that are so heinous that the death penalty should be considered, even if it's not carried out. But the fact that it could be imposed, number one, it gives the prosecutors leverage. It gives them another tool to use when they have to plea bargain the cases. Most cases end up being disposed of today in that manner. It also, what do you do if somebody has been convicted of convicted and has life without parole, and then he kills two or three more people while in prison? So there are certain instances when I believe the death penalty is appropriate. I believe that under those circumstances it should be carried out. Now, it hasn't in Maryland. If you're going to do it, and nobody looks forward to something like that, particularly me, but you do have to think about victims. When you have young children killed and grandmothers raped, and you have to think about the victim too. So the death penalty in certain circumstances, and provided the evidence is as incontrovertible as could be, I would be in favor of.
Mr. Cardin.
Thank you very much. So I came into the legislature 12 years ago tacitly in favor of the death penalty, and I spent years studying the issue. And I actually spent 2 years with the Wexner Heritage Fellowship Program and brought this to my teachers and asked them about it as a legislator who was going to be voting on this bill, knowing it was coming to the legislature. And I actually came out opposed to the death penalty. And let me explain to you why. First of all, Jewish tradition teaches us that if you put somebody to death more than once in every 70 years, it's too much. And there are different ways to handle that situation. Louis Brandeis from the Supreme Court said that if you leave, you're better off leaving 10 people free, 10 guilty men go free, than have one innocent person go to jail. And the fact is, how many people must go free to put one innocent person to death? And if we are not, this is not a perfect science, and we cannot be sure it's a perfect science, we have to be very careful about who we're giving the ultimate penalty to. So I would say that we have to be very careful about the death penalty. I am proud to have voted in favor of repealing it. But the biggest reason that all of us, and as an attorney general candidate, that we should be concerned about, while we have moral reasons, and we have ethical reasons, and we have substantive reasons in terms of the victim's rights, we also have to look at just the process and what's happening. The fact of the matter is that it costs us millions of dollars more to have a death penalty than to not. And we should be using that money to fight against violent crime. We should be using that money to reduce gang activity and not to keep people on death row when we can keep them in prison for life without parole. Thank you.
Okay. The next question is, what are your proposals to assist the state's attorneys whom the Attorney General represents in effectively fighting crime? And the order will be Mr. Pritzker, Mr. Cardin, and Mr. Frosch.
There's certain limited things that the Attorney General can do. When you say assist attorneys, most crime prosecution is handled by the state's attorney's offices in the various jurisdictions of the state of Maryland. There are certain limited aspects in which the Attorney General can assist those attorneys general. There's also an issue now as to when the attorney must first become involved in the criminal process, as perhaps some of you know, and the court has ruled that attorneys have to become available actually the first time when there's a bail review. So the Attorney General, of course, handles criminal appeals, and the death penalty, the substance of the argument we just had is very interesting because that's probably where a lot of the $1 million went in appeals of death penalty cases, which can go on for years. But the Attorney General's job is to assist with appeals and only to deal with certain crimes, for example, environmental crimes. And here's where we need a little bit of balance, and part of what I would do is look at everything that's on the books and determine that which should be enforced and that which hopefully we can talk to the legislature and probably get changed a little bit. But anything the Attorney General can do to help crimes, for example, I don't want to get into guns right now because that's not the question, but gang-related crimes and other things of that nature, obviously the Attorney General can use the bully pulpit and try to do whatever he can to encourage the state's attorneys and the various jurisdictions to fight crime as best they can. But it's really not primarily the duty of the Attorney General. That would be more for the state's attorneys in the various jurisdictions.
Mr. Cardin.
Thank you very much. Making sure that our children, our families are safe has to be the number one priority for the Attorney General's office. Reduction of violent crime, as I already mentioned, is and should be the number one priority. How do we fight violent crime? That's really the question. How do we do it from the Attorney General's office? Well, if you go to the National Association of Attorneys General and you work with them, which I have spent the last year trying to understand best practices from around the country, what you will find is that if the Attorney General is good and able to create cooperation between our local state's attorneys, our local police, our state police, and the federal authorities, are you good at negotiating and herding cats is really the question. If you can do that and bring those people together, you can fight violent crime. You can fight against gangs. You can fight the illegal gun trade. And that's what we need to do, number one. Number two, we're entering a new era of drug policy. As many of you know, we passed a decriminalization of marijuana bill. And the fact of the matter is we need to be spending our finite resources, our dollars, on fighting violent crime and not putting people in jail for nonviolent drug offenses, for smoking marijuana, or for possession of minor amounts of drugs. And finally, crime is increasingly moving to the internet. Let me repeat that. Crime is increasingly moving to the internet. We need to think about how we're going to deal with online gang recruitment, gun sales online, ID theft and voter ID voter impersonation online, and revenge porn. These are just a few examples of the kinds of online threats that we face. So I want to continue to make Maryland safe, and we need to do that online as well as on the streets. Thank you.
Mr. Frosch.
Thank you. Well, first, I wrote the law that gives the Attorney General jurisdiction to prosecute identity theft. And so that is one area in which the Attorney General has a direct responsibility and authority to prosecute crime at the street level. That obligation usually goes to our local state's attorneys. But I have also gone around the state, spoken to state's attorneys about how the Office of the Attorney General could best assist them. And what I have heard in return is they can use help on difficult legal issues. The Office of the Attorney General handles all criminal appeals from every single jurisdiction. So it would be economical, it would be conservative of resources for the Attorney General to engage earlier in certain situations where there's a complicated legal issue, where there's a big case and the local prosecutor needs boots on the ground. The Attorney General can delegate, can lend assistant attorneys general to that prosecutor and help prosecute those cases so that on appeal there is no issue, so that the issue is taken care of in the first instance. And I've been endorsed by police, by corrections officers, by sheriffs, and by state's attorneys all across the state because they know I'll be tough on crime, I will help them out, and I'll be smart on crime.
Okay. The next question is, what in your background and experience distinguishes you from your opponents? And the order will be Mr. Cardin, Mr. Frosch, and Mr. Pritzker.
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. You know, first let me say that I have tremendous respect for my opponents. They're both, we have one a good lawyer, one good legislator, but the task of the Attorney General is different than that of a legislator or that of a lawyer or that of a regular old lawyer. You have to, I shouldn't say regular lawyer, I apologize, Mr. Pritzker.
You could have called me something worse.
You are tasked as the Attorney General with enforcing the laws of the state and making sure that every Marylander is protected and is given a fair and equal opportunity. You have to do this with passion, conviction, and vision. And this is where I think I differ from my opponents. I understand the issues facing Maryland families today, and I understand the issues that they will be facing in the future. I was a leader on issues of reduction of cyber crimes, things like revenge porn and cyberbullying, made Maryland a national leader on cyberbullying. I understand both the promise and the perils of technology, and I want to bring that and bring what I've done on my campaign with understanding the perils and the opportunities of technology from the campaign to the office of the Attorney General. I want to make it a priority because our families, our children, our seniors, our businesses deserve to have somebody out there looking out and protecting them. But I also understand the timeless values, values that have been ingrained in me since I was a young man from the Baltimore Jewish Council, from my time at the Baltimore Hebrew University, and from my time with the Wexner Foundation, understanding Jewish values and bringing them, integrating them into my work in the Attorney General's office. Thank you.
Mr. Frosch.
Thank you. Let me say, I have been practicing law for more than 35 years. U.S. News and World Report named me one of the best lawyers in America. I have experience across a broad spectrum of legal issues from the private practice of law. As chairman of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, I get a 90-day course in continuing legal education every year on the issues that are at the core of the responsibilities of the Attorney General's office. And I have, in the General Assembly, taken on tough issues and resolved them time after time. The Firearm Safety Act was a classic example. We had a wave of opposition. We had extraordinary resistance to what I think was ultimately a very common sense measure. I was able to shepherd it through, and afterwards, my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle said, and they were quoted in the Baltimore Sun as saying, look, he's fair, he listens, he works with us, he compromises when he thinks we're right, and then he does his job. So I can work with Republicans, with Democrats, conservatives, progressives, and people of all views. The Maryland Recycling Act that I mentioned a few moments ago, when I introduced that bill, I was in the House of Delegates, it was opposed by the entire business community, Chamber of Commerce and everybody else. It was opposed by the Maryland Association of Counties. It was opposed by the municipalities. It was opposed by the Maryland Department of Environment, and it was opposed by the governor. I got it passed anyway. And Mickey Steinberg, who was then the lieutenant governor, helped me persuade Governor Schaefer to sign it. I've been able to do that time after time on tough legislative issues, tough legal issues, and that is why I think I'm qualified to be Maryland's Attorney General.
Please. Sorry, no applause until the end. Mr. Pritzker, please.
Yes. You asked, the question was, background and experience distinguishing each of us from our opponents. Well, number one, I have an R after my name instead of a D. That's something unusual. And it's really important. And the reason it's important is because this state has been run by an Annapolis power structure, primarily Democrats, for too many years now. And these wonderful legislators, and they are, they truly are, don't really understand that there's a lot of people that may not agree with all the Democrat ideas. They may not agree with all the tax increases. They may not agree with the rain tax. If you had an independent attorney general, that could have been challenged, and I would challenge it. And if I'm elected, I will challenge it. They have taken no action whatsoever. You have to ask yourself, the people's lawyer, Doug Gansler, why didn't he do something with regard to this health care fiasco? Everybody here works hard for their money. They work hard for the taxes they pay, $250 million, a quarter of $1 billion. The Democrats have done nothing, and they've done nothing because it's all part of a power structure where everybody scratches each other's back and everybody works things out, and Mr. Frosch is great at doing that and working with Republicans. I'm not criticizing him, but there are ideas that perhaps are different that we're not getting a chance to even experience. The Attorney General's position should be independent. Forget about the name Democrat, Republican. Realize that you need somebody to represent you. You need somebody to investigate this $250 million debacle. You need somebody to investigate how this was a sole source contract. How did that happen? No bid contract. How did that happen? Now, when you have a Democratic attorney general, legislature, and governor, you're never going to get the answers, and you're going to get what you have been getting, and it's not going to get better. So please consider that independence probably is the smartest thing that you could ask for an attorney general.
Okay. So the next question is,